just like point of clarification, I didn't hear it properly, I don't think. The question and answer session tomorrow, do you want, is that general with regard to the theme, or the theme and the Buddha specifically?
The theme. Of course, it's hard to keep the Buddha out of anything, so if he creeps in, we won't banish him. So we have to take our theme further, and I must say I have quite a bit of trepidation about where we're going next. I feel I'm entering upon mysteries, entering into the grove of mysteries with rather leaden feet, and well, angels would tremble to go where I'm going to go, but that's never stopped me up until now. It's a very difficult subject to get right, what I'm trying to approach today. So I want to start by referring to Bhante's exploration of the Ashubha and Shubha in the Three Jewels. I mentioned it yesterday. It really is a very, very important passage. I think, indeed, the Three Jewels is generally a neglected work amongst us. Bhante spoke to me of it as being at a high level of teaching, at a higher level, for instance, than the survey. It's a much more intricate and complex work with a much more deeper spiritual perspective. But what he has to say about the Ashubha and Shubha is really fundamental to everything we're talking about. So he says in this passage on the Ashubha, which is in the chapter on the nature of existence, a very important chapter, to which there is a very good commentary from Bhante. So he says, Shubha, literally purity, really means beauty, though beauty of the spiritual rather than the sensuous order. It is pure beauty in the Platonic and Neoplatonic sense of something shining in a world of its own above and beyond concrete things, which are termed beautiful only so far as they participate in its perfection. I'll read that again, in case I get asked. Pranyagupta might ask me again. Shubha literally means purity. Shubha literally purity really means beauty, though beauty of the spiritual rather than of the sensuous order. It is pure beauty in the Platonic and Neoplatonic sense of something shining in a world of its own above and beyond concrete things, which are termed beautiful only so far as they participate in its perfection. We're in the land of metaphor here, not solid philosophy, be careful. The question arises, why do we find some things beautiful rather than other things? Why do we find some things more beautiful than other things? Why do I find something beautiful that you don't find beautiful? Why does somebody attract me as beautiful and not you? That's the question I want to try to address today. And it has these two aspects to it. It has, if you like, an objective and a subjective dimension to it. To start with the objective dimension to it, something about the object itself which reflects that pure beauty hovering in a realm of its own above and beyond. Something about the object enables that reflection to take place more or less adequately. In a sense, you could say that everything reflects that beauty, that pure beauty. If the eye is sufficiently open, beauty is everywhere. Beauty is even in ugliness. But some objects, some people, some situations, some configurations within sensuous reality reflect that pure beauty, ideal beauty, more adequately, more readily than others. Precisely why is, I think, in the end, a mystery. It's not really possible to say. it's the subject of so much aesthetic theory, the subject of so much criticism, literary and artistic and so on. Why is that particular painting, that particular poem, that particular play, that particular film, that particular scene beautiful and that one isn't? There's a lot of discussion and debate about that, and perhaps there will never be a conclusion to that debate. But one thing we do know is that different objects, objects in the general sense, including persons, are more or less able to reflect that ideal beauty. A bit like some lightning is attracted to, you know, particular objects. If they're iron, if they're high and so forth, then lightning more easily goes to ground. Other things don't attract the lightning. Although in the end, lightning can strike anywhere. So there's something about objects themselves and their configuration that more or less adequately expresses or becomes a vehicle for, a channel for, that ideal beauty. And that is a large topic in itself, which is worthy of close examination. Every time we see something beautiful, the response is immediate and intuitive in the sense of being direct. But when we begin to reflect on our responses, we're exploring why that particular object, in the sense I've been speaking of object, does reflect that ideal beauty. Why did that film capture something that another film didn't? Why did that particular painting bring you close to beauty in a way that another didn't? And so on. That's the subject of our discussion about aesthetics. We're trying to explore what it is that makes something beautiful. In the end, what makes it beautiful is the fact that you respond to it. In the end, beauty is unquestionable, or the response to beauty is unquestionable. So that's the objective dimension. But there is a subjective element to it. Why is it that when you walk around that art gallery of very great paintings, why is it that some grab you and some don't? Even though kind of objectively you know they're great works and you could even talk intelligently about them, they don't sort of pull your heart in the way that others do. Why does this poem grab you and that one doesn't? Why does that particular sunset really move you in a way that last night's didn't? That to some extent is to do with us. It's to some extent a subjective question. It depends upon who we are. And this is where the question, the mysteries begin. I'm going to try to explore this using reflections of Bante's in a simple and brief way, because I think there's very important practical significance to this. So why is it that I respond to this and you respond to that, whilst this leaves you cold, and so on? Why is it? And yet, at the same time, you can, in a certain sense, say that the object itself is a better or more adequate expression of the beautiful. Why is it that some of those greatly adequate expressions appeal to me and not to you, and so on? Well, Bante argues that this is to do with our constitution as beings, as human beings. And I need to take a step back and look what it is to be a human being, or what it is to be aware, what it is to be awake. You could say that what it is to be aware, you could say that all the time reality is evident to us. The true nature of things is there before us at every moment. Things are impermanent. They are insubstantial. They are lacking in the capacity. Conditioned things are lacking in the capacity to give us real satisfaction. And things are always, at the conditioned level, pale reflections of the ideal beauty. All the time, reality is pressing upon us. And really, you could say, what we are is a defense against reality. What it is to be a human being, to be an identity, to have an identity, is to defend oneself against reality. Our identity is constantly threatened, undermined, denied by reality. At every moment, reality is laughing at our pretensions to independent selfhood. All the time. And our identity is a rear guard action against impermanence, insubstantiality, suffering, and unattractiveness. The unattractiveness of the conditioned. It's a rear guard action. We're fighting all the time to hold it together. Don't you know it? Constantly trying to piece it all together, telling yourself a story that reconfigures everything that's going on so that you can hold it together. You know, my favourite neurologist, Oliver Sacks, describes people with severe brain damage and their, the revelation that makes of what we are doing. Because they're doing it badly. They don't have the same equipment. So he talks about somebody who's lost short and medium-term memory. He's got about 5 minutes of short-term memory, and then nothing for 30 years. So all the time, this man who he calls the confabulator is telling a story that connects the last 5 minutes with 30 years ago. And, of course, the last 5 minutes is constantly moving forward with the arrow of time. And so the story is constantly falling apart and he's constantly juggling it back together again. A really, really painful story to read, actually, to think of the state of mind that goes with that. That's what we're doing. We've got better equipment at the moment, but that's fundamentally what we're doing. We're fighting a rear guard action against impermanence and insubstantiality and the inadequacy of life to grant us real satisfaction and beauty as we take it usually. So reality is pressing in upon us all the time. It's not just pressing in upon us in the, as it were, negative form or in the form of our recognition of the inadequacy of our attachments. Is pressing in upon us in the sense of the vimokshamukkas. It's pressing in upon us in the sense of the recognition that life is beyond our knowing. That life does not require us to fix it. Life is king. It is constantly pressing upon us with the message that life is completely open. There's no closed boundaries. Nothing is fixed. Nothing is finished. Everything is open. It's pressing upon us with the sense that there's nowhere to go. Nothing to do. Everything is here now. It's pressing upon us with this ideal beauty. So all the time we're defending ourselves oddly against both reality in the form of the Lakshanas and reality in the form of the Vimokshamukkas. But those Vimokshamukkas, and especially here, of course, I'm talking about beauty. They're pressing in upon us. And although we fight a strong action against them, they do affect us. They do influence us. And if we become at all sensitive, we begin to accept them into our lives. We stop fighting. We begin to open up and allow reality a place at least a place, a corner in our minds, in our hearts. And perhaps the most powerful way in which reality presents itself to us is in terms of beauty. We allow ourselves, our capacity for reality, to respond to beauty in the world around us. But reality expresses itself or impacts upon our empirical self. Each of us is absolutely particular. We have our own physical makeup, we have our own history, our own cultural background, and so forth, our own family history. We are, all of us, completely unique. And the impact of reality upon us, therefore, is particular, if you see what I mean. Bhante described this as a bit like, you know, one of those scientific experiments where you have a sand pit and then a violin string strung over the pit, and you pluck the string and you see the sand forming waves, patterned by the sound waves from the violin string. Do you get the image? So that the violin string here represents that the sound of reality, if you like, and it patterns our particular heap of sand, skander of sand. And it patterns it in its own particular way, depending on the weight and quality and fineness of the sand, the pattern will form, and so many other things. So each of us, as it were, receives the imprint of reality. Oh, such clunky language, as if, you know, you're making reality into something that does imprinting. But what else can you do if you're going to talk? Each of us receives the imprint of reality in a particular way. Of course, there are general patterns that you can see, you can discern, general rules and laws and so forth. But absolutely uniquely does that pattern express itself in each of us. And when I say pattern, it's not just a sort of static pattern. It's more like a force. But the force expresses itself in us in a way that is unique to each of us. So Bhante has a lot to say about this in that passage on the Gestalt that we printed out for you in the bundle. It's had enormous impact on me when I was on the seminar where Bhante spoke about it, and it really powerfully impacted on me and gave me for the first time a really strong, vivid sense of what I was doing with my Dhamma life. I could for the first time make sense of the processes that were working within me. This strong sense, I've got to do something. I don't quite know what it is and I don't quite know why, but I've got to do it. And a strong sense that this is right, this is not right, or this is right for me, and so on. It gave me for the first time a sense that my life had a meaning. Bhante spoke of it recalling something that Mozart apparently had said about his own musical composition. Mozart apparently reported that his musical compositions, even his symphonies, would present themselves to him in a moment outside time. The whole symphony was represented in a single moment, timeless moment, and that then the writing down of the symphony was the working out of that timeless experience. I know this in my own small way. For instance, with giving a talk. Now, I'm giving you a talk now, and the germ of that talk, it's an agonizing process, I find, because these days I can't prepare. I just can't, because by the time I give the talk, what I've prepared isn't what I want to say. So I have to try to sort of get hold of the gestalt, the whole of the talk. And I you know, got a few threads and a few patterns, but then I have to work them out. It's nerve-wracking because I just wonder whether I'm going to manage it. I still haven't finished. So even this talk, you know, I really only finally got hold of it in the just sitting this morning. I knew what I was going to say, although I didn't know the words I was going to use. Something sort of crystallized, something that seemed to come from a larger dimension, crystallized, and then I've been thinking about how I'll unfold it, and now I'm trying to do it. So Bhante says, that's our lives. It's as if our lives are a reflection within time of something outside time. And again, this is metaphor. I'm not doing philosophy here. Don't nail me down on this. This is poetry. That it's as if we exist outside time, in the realm of reality, if you like. And our mundane existence, our time-based spatio-temporal existence, is a working out of something ultimate that we cannot yet know in a whole. And we work it out without really knowing what we're doing. Often we work it out sort of against the current of other forces within us. Sometimes other forces within us appropriate that powerful drive within us. So, you know, you find in so much religion, you can sense so much that's genuine and so much that's even evil. I've often spoken about reading a biography of Ayatollah Khomeini, which of course I found on Padmavadra's shelf. It's a little bit worrying about Padmaloka, but the Ayatollah, you know, who's responsible for the death of a million people, I believe, in the Iraq-Iran war, was a great lover of Persian love poetry, Sufi poetry. And apparently not a great poet, but, you know, wrote quite a bit of poetry, clearly a mystic. But that obviously very genuine, and you sense that, it's a very genuine impulse to something higher, got mixed up with something altogether darker and more sinister. And so that the current of that drive gets sort of diverted into something much more egoistic and, in this case, even downright evil. So much evil done by great ideas. The history of religion is littered with it. And not just religion, but quasi-religion like Marxism. So we are the expression of something that it belongs outside time, as a sort of idea of ourselves. Again, please, metaphor, not philosophy. Something an idea of ourselves that exists outside time. Some the Kantians amongst you, Kant's transcendental self. But that. That idea of oneself living, existing, it doesn't exist, that belongs outside time, that is at the limits of the knowable, works itself out in time through the particularities of our body, mind, construct. Our Dhamma life in the end is an attempt to work with these forces that are trying to express themselves within us and which are often unknowable to us. We don't really know what we're doing. We don't know why we're attracted to this rather than that. And part of what I'm wanting to say this morning, and I think Padmavadra is going to expand upon this much further with his own peculiar example, peculiar in the sense of particular, and possibly another sense too. Often we don't know what we're doing, and it's important that we don't know what we're doing, because if we did know what we're doing, it wouldn't be the thing to do, if you see what I mean, because we'd already kind of thought out the end, and what we were doing wouldn't be an exploration, a discovery. So it's important that we have a strong sense that we're working something out that we don't really understand, and that we rely upon our own integrity to determine whether we're getting it right or wrong. so that we know, no, this is wrong. Maybe we know, we think this is right, and then after some time we realise, no, I've got this too shallow, I've got it diverted, I've got sidetracked. And you have to go back and come back onto the path again. So many times in my life I've gone up gum trees, for the Australians present, up blind alleys, and then had to work my way back to my starting point. Often go back to the kindergarten of the Dhamma life, which is where we really belong. And work one's way forward from there, trying to discover that naturally unfolding erotic force. This is what I mean by eros. It's the force of desire that seeks, although you don't know it, an ultimate fulfillment. It's faith. But it's faith experienced not as a strong sense of, yes, I'm for the Buddha, but more of a strong sense that this is what I must do. This is what draws me. This is what attracts me. Bhante speaks very eloquently about this in St. Jerome Revisited, which is another very important paper. There's a whole set of papers around these themes, which I think are some of the most important and unique contributions of Bhante to the development of Buddhism in the West, because they're not straightforward expositions of traditional Dhamma. They're expositions in terms of the Western aesthetic sensibility. To my mind, this is the real development of a Western Tantra. It's not drawing on Tibet, which is okay. So, Tantra. It's the equivalent of the Vajrayana, if you see what I mean. But, of course, it's the aesthetical yana. Bhante talks about his own attraction to the image of St. Jerome in his cave translating the Vulgate. Bhante very eloquently and movingly unpacks the image, just as he does with the Conde de Orgaz. He shows why he's attracted to it, and he speaks about his own attraction. And it illustrates very clearly this very particularity of the erotic drive towards an ideal beauty, which is unique to each of us, although we may share to substantial degrees certain aspects of it. In the end, it's unique to every one of us. And unless we are in contact with that unfolding gestalt, that unfolding erotic drive, we won't really have a Dhamma life. What we'll be living is our idea of the Dhamma life based on merely theory, if you see what I mean. It won't be connected with what is actually unfolding within us. I remember a very good friend of mine saying that at a certain point in his Dhamma life, he realized that there were very strong foundations for his Dhamma life from early experiences. But then he built the sort of edifice of his Dhamma life, not on those foundations, but next door to them. And he had to knock it down and come back to the foundations. I always think of that wonderful moment when C.G. Jung found himself unable any longer to go along with Freud's psychoanalysis. And it completely destroyed him for a while. He had no way of knowing how to go forward. And so he just resorted to play. He'd sit on the ground and play like an infant. Playing with colours, playing with shapes, and gradually finding that inner erotic movement, which Jung, up to a certain point, is a very important explorer of. I think very important for us in the West. Without Jung, I think it'd be very difficult to understand a lot of these things, but we have to go beyond him too. So we respond to beauty in the object because the object, to a greater or lesser extent, is a channel for that beauty, a more or less adequate vehicle for that beauty. but we respond to the beauty in a particular way because of the unfolding process within us. And the pursuit of beauty is at the junction of these two processes, where we're seeking beauty in the object from our own erotic drive, if you see what I mean. By erotic drive, I mean this powerful, deep current that's mixed up in all our desire. Our desire for anything, however apparently gross, is a pale, distant reflection of that deeper current. And that's why we mustn't deny our desires, but try to explore them and lead them where they really want to go, or where they find their ultimate fulfillment. So Bhante talked about each of us needing to discover our own myth. This is much abused language. It's not that my myth is the myth of Perseus. It's not like that. A myth isn't an off-the-peg thing. That's exactly what we shouldn't be doing. It's not going to be like that. Although particular public myths may appeal to you and express for you something of what it is that you're trying to work out. But it's as if we are myths. That is who we are. We are mythic beings existing within the plane of space and time. And what we need to discover is that myth that underlies us, that is us really. And we need to do that with great integrity, great mindfulness, and to also with great joy. We need to find pleasure in it, find satisfaction in it. When you really do feel, you've got something of the pattern, something of the myth, you feel such satisfaction. Often you don't get the whole thing. Maybe when you get the whole thing, you're there, if you see what I mean. What you get is certain aspects of it, certain reflections. Bhante said it's a bit like a Persian carpet, that, you know, there are various weavers weaving the carpet from different ends. And somebody's weaving a flower here. Somebody's weaving a tendril here. Somebody's weaving an architectural shape here. You don't see how it all fits together. You know it's all part of the pattern, but you don't know what the pattern is. So we need to be finding those elements that do reflect the pattern. So I'm going to stop speaking now, and Padmavajra, I believe, is going to talk about something of his own exploration of that pattern, that myth, and how it's worked out in him. I hope that's what he's going to do, because I've just said it. Anyway, he's going to do whatever he does, and I'm sure it'll be wonderful.